And so we're going to talk about today the power of really good secrets. Let me ask you a warm-up question. Feels like you need to be warmed up a little bit. You're pretty late arriving this morning. So everybody dragging their feet. Let's make sure that your brain juices are flowing. Very subjective. I might not want to answer this one out loud. The question is, can you be trusted? Think about it. Can you be trusted? Think about it. If it helps you kind of slide into it, do a little side eye to the person next to you and think, can they be trusted? And now back to you. Can you be trusted? How many of you think you have a good answer to that? I'm not going to ask you what your answer is. I'm going to say, oh, that's a question that I feel like I can answer. Because here's the really interesting follow-on question. Why? Why do you think you can be trusted, or why do you think you can't be trusted? And that's kind of what I want everybody thinking about this morning. We're in this sermon series on the Sermon on the Mount, which is Jesus' most famous teaching of all. It's about a 20-minute sermon that he gives in the early chapters of the Gospel of Matthew. There's another version of it in Luke and smatterings of it elsewhere. It is, as I have claimed every week in this series, by far the most revolutionary moral teaching in world history. There's nothing that comes even remotely close. You can tell how revolutionary it's been in our own culture by all the popular phrases that we borrow from it. Even non-believers quote without even thinking. You know, do unto others, you'd have them do unto you. Hey, turn the other cheek. Hey, don't judge. All of those things are from the Sermon on the Mount. And they really helped establish, society as we know it around us. You can read through it in the Bible and not realize how revolutionary the statements were because they've become such a big part of who we are now. So it was absolutely stunning to the crowd that was listening to it, an absolute clarion call to spiritual revolution in the world. We are several weeks into the sermon series now. Jesus is preaching the Sermon on the Mount to a crowd of hundreds and hundreds of people, maybe thousands. And it's a really wretched crowd, a lot of sick people, a lot of demonized people, a lot of very, very poor people, people from different regions. A lot of foreigners would have been there, a lot of language barriers. It was really kind of a mess. And he looks out at them, and the first thing he says is, "You guys are blessed." He starts with these blessifications. The things that you think make you wretched actually give you a huge advantage in life. That was his opening salvo. And then from there, he goes on to say, and you're better than you think you are. You're the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. I think if I were to ask you, who's the light of the world? If you're a veteran Christian, you might say Jesus. But Jesus would say, actually you. You're the light of the world. And he charges them with this call to incredible significance. Well, that's attention getting. And then he shifts from there and he talks about moral laws, the Old Testament laws that at least the Jewish people in the crowd would have been familiar with. And he raises the stakes. He says it's not about the letter of the law, it's about the spirit of the law. And in so doing, he sort of encourages them to say, even the people that you think are really righteous aren't that much better than you. On the other hand, like the standards, the spiritual standards are so high that nobody really has hope of perfecting them. And so sort of a good news, bad news thing. He sets the crowd up for his next thunderous point, which is, God does not judge you according to your perfection. He judges you according to your authenticity, right? Are you faking? Like, I know you're imperfect. I'm not necessarily expecting you to be perfect, he says. But are you authentic about it? Nobody gets to fake in the kingdom of heaven. You got to be honest about your mistakes, and you have to honestly try to excel. And that's just sort of a shift in spiritual teaching on planet Earth when he starts talking about that. And then he expounds on it for a while, sort of gives some contemplations and meditations about it. And last week we talked about this juxtaposition, this contrast that he sets up in chapter 6 of Matthew, where he says, think about it this way. Think of the difference between being privately sincere and publicly hypocritical. Like, you don't want to pray in public and just sort of posture and show off to people. You want to do your significant spiritual work in private. Why? Well, because the things that you do in secret are the things that make you authentic. You are who you are when nobody is looking. And so he talks about that for a while, just to sort of introduce this idea to authenticity to the crowd, which is something that probably, you know, modern Christians would be fairly familiar with. But again, in the day, he was revolutionary. So last week, we talked about secret practices, like secret prayer, like your morning devotions and stuff like that. You have to have a private life with God. If you don't have a private life with God, then it's going to be very hard for you to be authentic in public life. That make sense? And then this week, we're going to take a slight variation on that. Instead of talking about secret practices, like prayer and whatnot, we're going to talk about secret sacrifices. A little bit different. And the massive blessing of having a secret sacrifice life. Have you ever met anyone who seems like they're more than meets the eye? Like, you meet them, and then, like, the more you know them, the more you realize, wow, there's a lot to this person that I didn't see in the first instance. Or maybe you just meet someone, and you're interacting with them, and they feel like there's a lot of power behind them somewhere, and you're like, where is this coming from? Like, I don't see why you have this much power, or why you have this much influence, or why you feel the way that you do. You ever know anybody like that? I was thinking about people like that this week, and the guy that I thought about really quickly was this coach that I had, middle school and high school both. He moved up with me. His name was Jay McRoberts. And I went to this Podunk High School in the middle of nowhere in southern Oregon. And just a little school, even in our conference, we were sort of the little poor school. And he was a little poor coach at that school and helped build some impressive programs, actually. But when you met Coach McRoberts, you would not have been impressed. One, he didn't look athletic at all. He'd been born with a club foot, and though he had it surgically altered, he still limped a little bit his whole life. So he's never much of an athlete, but he loved sports, and somehow that made him a good coach. He looked kind of, not very fit, not super attractive. He was unmarried, he was single, that I came to learn over the years, bothered him a little bit. He got married late in life. But he had something to him, you know, and all the kids responded to it. He was a really sound Christian man. And just to give the idea, I remember like in middle school, which is where I initially met him, he would do Letterman Club's meeting on Friday morning. So all the athletes who had earned letters got to go to this club meeting where ostensibly you talked about sports. And when we go down to the male locker room, this was gender specific, this was back in the day, go down to the boys' locker room, and people would crowd in for these meetings. Kids would sneak in who were not athletes just to be there. That's how popular they were. And then, instead of talking about sports, he would preach. I mean, he would preach for 30 minutes before school started. And, you know, kids would come to the Lord. He would save lives. It was a very, very poor, very troubled area of the world. Lots of fractured families, created families out of children without families. It was the most powerful experience I had, bar none, for about a stretch of years in my life. And everybody felt it. Like, you'd meet the guy and you think, I'm not sure how he's getting away with it. Right? And then I sort of grew up, And he allowed me a bit more into his inner circle and became part of his ministry team, although he never called it that. Just like, Gordon, you're an influencer. You know, learn how to influence people. That was my seminary. I'll tell you that right now. He died a few years back. And hundreds and hundreds of students over the years just came to his funeral. Never had a family of his own. Massively influential guy. The guy could be trusted. He is, to this day, the only person in life on whose shoulder I have cried. Like, literally. Cried, and I did it twice, dang it. He would watch me, and when I would get depressed and start to drift, or things in my home were going really poorly, he'd pull me aside, and let me take you home after practice. And we drive, and he talked to me about the future and tell me that I could make it. Anyway, I could talk all day long about J. McRoberts, as you could tell. The least impressive person you ever met in your life. Probably one of the most powerful people you ever met in your life, and you would not have been able to explain why. All right, now with that set up, let's read Matthew 6, 16 through 18. It's just a few verses, and believe it or not, they're verses on fasting. That's my segue. Now we're going to talk about the spiritual practice of fasting. Do you know what fasting is? Fasting is when you don't eat for a period of time in order to mortify the flesh. There's a phrase nobody uses anymore, mortification. Everybody say mortification. Mortification. You know what that means? Literally, it means deathification. Which is just a far better word. It's like, yes, Christian deathification. Everybody?
Deathification.
Careful how you say that. To make dead, to mortify, to sort of put your flesh in its place in order that your spirit, your willpower, your good choices can be freer in their pursuits and practices. So we're going to talk about fasting. And it was a reasonably common practice in Jesus' day, part of his culture's religious practice. When you fast, do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show men they are fasting. I tell you the truth, they have received their reward in full. But when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face, get gussied up, so that it will not be obvious to anyone that you are fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. The Jews of the day, and a big part of the crowd would have been Jewish, were required to fast. Bible trivia, how many days out of the year? Nobody from my Ohana group gets to answer. 1 day a year. They were required to fast once a year, the Day of Atonement. And it was a way to sort of mortify their fleshly desires, their shallower desires, their temporal desires, the mundane desires, and humble themselves before the Lord in order to kind of focus on spiritual atonement and, you know, personal inventories and doing better in the coming year, receiving forgiveness and stuff like that. So there was a huge revival movement in Jesus' day. It was a revival not in the sense that we think of a Christian revival, but a revival of the Jewish religion, and it was led by these people called the Pharisees. They were a religious party that also became politically influential. And the Pharisees were trying to convince the rest of society that you needed to be more serious about the Old Testament laws than you were. You got to be more religious than you are. And they actually were Jesus's chief opponents. In the gospel. They were always ragging on him because he didn't seem religious enough for them. And the Pharisees famously fasted twice a week. So they only ate 5 out of 7 days. And they thought that that was the proper model through which to inspire the rest of society. So when they would fast on their fast days, they would change how they would dress. Instead of, like, you know, putting the product in their hair and, you know, wearing clean clothes and nice clothes and looking really proper and professional, they would put, like, sackcloth on, like a burlap sack over their bodies, and they wouldn't put product in their hair. That's what it means, oil your hair. Wouldn't brush their teeth and stuff. And they would go out in public and just sort of look miserable to everybody in order to say, look, I'm fasting. Don't you feel guilty? Don't you feel like you should? I'm simplifying a little bit, but that's kind of what they did. And they did that in the name of modeling, in the name of inspiration, in the name of leadership. Let me show you how much I hurt so that you too can join me in this painful exercise. You wretched sinners, you. So it was sort of that sort of deal. And Jesus was like, man, when you fast, don't play that game. And he'd already set this up. Like, when you pray, don't pray publicly with flowery language for show and stuff like that. There's nothing about that that's really authentic. Like, maybe they authentically want to change society, but it's like they're not really thinking hard about God, are they? They're thinking about, they're not thinking about how you see God. They're thinking about how you see them. And so that they've sort of intervened in the process. So that's what's going on with the Pharisees. It's interesting to note that Jesus presumed that people would fast. When you fast, don't put on a somber face like the hypocrites do. Hypocrite means mask wearer. And so there's a little play on words here. Don't put on a mask like the masked people do. For they disfigure their faces, just so men, they are fasting. What's your fasting face? Like, if you hadn't eaten for 24 hours, what would your face look like? One, two, three, go. Yeah, you kind of suck at that. This is my fasting face. This is my happy face. It's pretty much my face. You want expression, see my wife. She gets up here and gives announcements, and by the end of it, I'm tired. It's like, this is so much emotion there. You're so excited. I'm exhausted. Yeah, you're emoting for two. All right. So Jesus says, when you fast, I know that you're going to do this. You know, it's a good practice, in other words. Jesus is advocating that you do this sacrifice of not eating. There are probably other fasts that you could do as well. You know, you could fast from social media. He doesn't mention that for some reason. But different addictions or dependencies that you can give up for a while, that sort of thing is good for you. Talk about why in a second. And famously, before Jesus started his ministry, he fasted for 40 days. He was led by the Spirit to do so. So in other words, the Holy Spirit thinks that fasting is a good idea. I have whole teachings about this. I actually have a chapter in a book I wrote about this, about how sacrifice releases power in your life. I think whenever you sacrifice some sort of mundane appetite, whether it be for food or drink or you know, entertainment or comfort, all sorts of comfort fasts that you can do. People do sleep fast. People do money fasts, where you live, you know, for a length of time without spending money on things. There's all sorts of ways that you can put passions and appetites to death forcibly. That's really what fasting is. And when Jesus fasted for 40 days in the wilderness, the enemy came and tempted him with all manner of sin, right? So it was a contest of which appetite prevails. Is it your appetite for God in transcendence, or is it your appetite for chocolate? And for some of us, that's a close run race. You know, for me, it would be like coffee. Like, you know, I fast coffee. You do not want to be around me, right? Because you develop certain rituals and dependencies. But Jesus fasted for 40 days. Never made it that far myself. People say, well, after you don't eat for 3 days, then you're no longer hungry. That's a lie. I fast for 3 days and I can't get out of bed, pass out. Some of us have metabolisms. I'm a thin guy. But I have plenty of friends who have done 40 days. So I'm just mentioning that so that you don't just like flush this out of your mind. It's like, no, this is something that spiritual people do. Jesus did it for the sake of spiritual resistance. You know, if you cannot eat for 40 days, there are very few temptations you're not able to resist at that point. So that's kind of what you're accomplishing. It's like, oh, I'm really being tempted to be prideful. I'm really being tempted to be lustful. I'm really struggling with this addictive behavior. Give up food for 40 days, right? And then that muscle that you develop, that muscle to resist your drives, just gets really strong, right? So it's a very crude tool, fasting, but super, super powerful. I've never done a fast of 7 days or more that has not permanently changed my life in some way. I don't do a lot of fasts of 7 days or more, so don't get the wrong idea. But it's a super powerful tool, and one that Jesus practiced, obviously, and that Jesus advocates that we use. And once you get your appetite squared away, then I think the Holy Spirit can flow through you a lot better, you know, because there's less hang-ups, there's less snags, your pipes are clean, so to speak. I could say more about that, but you get the idea, right? We studied this passage in my Ohana group on Wednesday. We studied this passage on secret fasting in my Ohana group on Wednesday, and everybody wanted to share their stories of fasting. But the reason they wanted to do that is because everybody had found it to be so fruitful and helpful. It's like, oh, this is something that has really accelerated my life. So I advocate that to you. You can talk about it in your Ohana groups, and people can give you tips and stories and stuff like that that will be inspiring and encouraging. If you want to make your practices of fasting more powerful, do it secretly. Don't tell anyone about it, because the secrecy is an added mortification. It makes sure that you don't blunt your sacrifice. Because if I'm, you know, on like day five or six of a fast, maybe, you know, maybe Satan comes to me in my wilderness, as he came to Jesus in his, and says, you know what? You're really doing great. You're more spiritual than I thought you were. Wow, you know, people would really be blessed to know how spiritual you are. You're a leader. You should probably model this in front of everyone. And pretty soon you've squandered it with pride, right? And that's how he gets you. And Jesus is warning against that. It's like, no, that's one of those temptations that fasting should help you tamp down. Right? Don't do it and then ruin it by trying to show off how cool you are, how spiritual you are. Nobody's going to believe you're very spiritual anyway. I mean, look around. He didn't say that, but I don't know, maybe he did. He said stuff like that to his disciples on occasion. It's like, nobody's all that. So you're doing this to help yourself, not to impress anybody. And we understand that. In that spirit, I would say that this short passage is really not a passage about fasting, is it? Fasting is merely an illustration for the deeper teaching. It's not a passage about fasting. It's a passage about the power of secret sacrifice. You know, making sure that you have a secret sacrificial life. If you have a secret sacrificial life, you'll be a more authentic person and you'll be a more powerful person. There will be more than meets the eye in you. You'll become one of those people. It's like, I don't even know how this person is so powerful. I'm not sure why this person is so impressive I'm not sure why this person seems so trustworthy. But doggone it, they do. There's something going on here behind the scenes. Well, you want to have a behind the scenes in your life so that you can be that kind of person. And to have a behind the scenes in your life, you have to have secrets. A lot of us have not so nice secrets. Not so nice parts of our life that are secret, that we keep secret because we're humiliated by them. Well, you want to have parts of your life that are really good, that you would be tempted to share because they're so cool, but you don't. And that is the antithesis of the other. Are you following me? You want to be more than meets the eye. You want to be able to look at somebody and say, oh, you have no idea. And actually say it truly. You have no idea what's going on in my life. You have no idea about, well, all the mess, true that. But you have no idea about all the secret sacrifices, the cultivation of secret blessedness. And I'm not going to tell you, but I'm going to bless you from it. Are you following?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the kind of guy Jay McRoberts was. It was definitely the kind of guy that Jesus was. He does his fasting alone in the wilderness, and that's the best place to do fasting. That's the best place to do sacrifices of different sorts. It's a way to practice not needing the validation of other people. Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't it be great to develop a capacity in yourself to not need validation from anyone else? Wouldn't it be great if, like, the most sacrificial, righteous parts of your life were secret and you didn't need anybody to know about it? You know, you stand on your own two feet before God and have that be plenty. Wouldn't that be cool to be that free? Wouldn't that be nice? Never have to worry about what people thought of you. Wouldn't that be cool? Never worry about what people had, what their opinions were of you. That would be nice. Well, how do you become that kind of person? Secretly is how. You have to do it secretly. All these people, it's become quite popular today, and I think you'll know what I'm talking about. It's become quite popular today to behave shamelessly in front of people. And people do that, I think, to sort of develop in themselves a capacity to not care what people think. At least that's what they're convincing themselves that they're doing. That's not the way to do it. The way to do it is to do good stuff behind the scenes that nobody knows about. Right? See the difference? That's really where shamelessness comes from. Shamelessness comes from the part of the iceberg that's below the surface that nobody ever sees. That's why you're stable. That's why you float upright, so to speak. Anyway, that's what's going on. But there's a deeper thing here, and this and what Jesus is driving at. He says, when you fast, keep it secret from everyone. Don't make it obvious to anyone, but only to your Father who's unseen. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And that Greek word for reward means he'll pay you. He will compensate you. He will respond to you appropriately. That's what the Greek word means. The promise here is that God rewards sacrifices that you do in secret. And I ask myself, why? Why would he reward that? Well, I think God is looking to reward us all the time. He's just a generous dude, and Jesus keeps referring to him as our Father, and fathers want to bless their children. So there's that. But when you do sacrifices in secret, you become trustworthy. God can trust you because he knows that you're not going to be manipulated by people. And if you become the sort of person who can't be manipulated by people, right, who don't follow people but follow him, who don't even value what people think of them but only what God thinks of them, if you're that kind of person, then God can totally trust you with all manner of resources and power. This is about becoming deeply trustworthy. And the way to become deeply trustworthy is secretly. That's the best way. Are you following?
Yes.
And if he can trust you, he can give you rewards and resources of all sorts. And I think this is why sacrifice releases power. And this is especially why secret sacrifice releases great power in your life from the Lord. It releases deep, spiritual, transcendent, miracle-working power. It'll be way more to you than meets the eye. Way more to you than meets the eye. So you want to be more than meets the eye. You want to have these secret practices that sort of make you authentic before the Lord, and you want to have these secret sacrifices that make you trustworthy before the Lord so that he can make you powerful before people. And if you're following along the Sermon on the Mount closely, you know that in chapter 5, Jesus says, you are the light of the world. Practice your good deeds before men that they might see your good deeds and give glory to your Father in heaven. So it sounds like Jesus is saying, do good things in front of people, which is not secret. And then in chapter 6, he's like, keep all the good stuff secret. The good deeds that you do in front of people are designed to glorify God. The good deeds that you do in secret are designed to empower you, that you can do good deeds in front of people to glorify God, right? You don't become more powerful by practicing good deeds in front of people. I don't become more powerful by preaching, in front of crowds. If there's any power in my preaching, it's, because of stuff that I've done in private. And let me tell you about those private things that I do. No, they're not that impressive anyway. So that's the juxtaposition that he's talking about. You get to be a shining light in public because of the things that you do behind the curtain. And that's what Jesus is driving at. That's the revolution that he is teaching. So you want to be more than meets the eye, have these secret sacrifices. The secret mortifications, maybe you want to spend chunks of time not eating. Maybe you want to do that regularly. Maybe you want to give up other secret comforts or addictions or dependencies that you have in order to, deathify some things that would benefit from that. You'd benefit from developing a little more freedom from. Plenty of people around Blue Water practice these sorts of mortifications, these types of fasting regularly. So go to an Ahana group and have a chat about it. You'll get plenty of good ideas and wisdom that way. There are also sacrifices of secret kindnesses. I really like this, like good deeds done for people in secret. Like maybe you can give secret gifts to people. From time to time, somebody gives me an envelope of cash and says, pass it to so-and-so. You don't know where it came from. Right? And I like that. Or sometimes people just leave envelopes of cash like on my desk and trusting me to get the cash where it should go. So I don't know who it came from. There's only a note that says, give it to so-and-so because so-and-so is struggling financially. I love that about Blue Water. Everybody wins in that scenario. Everybody wins and nobody shows off. One of my most cherished stories is I didn't have a church-going family when I was growing up. When I was in high school, I was the only one in my family that ever went to church, and that was only if I hitched a ride with someone. But I got involved with this church that was really growing explosively. It was in Rouge, Oregon, a town of 800. And the church, by the time I left for college, had 3,000 people in it. And they decided to build this church. They carved a hunk out of a mountain and built a huge amphitheater so that people could sit in it. And they were building this building. My dad worked in construction and eventually sold building supplies. So what he did, essentially, I didn't ask too many questions about this, but I think he essentially stole a bunch of hardware over the years and had all of these doorknobs and window fittings and stuff like that. And then he put them in his truck and drove out to the church one night and dumped it on their doorstep. because he knew that the church didn't have enough money to finish the building. And that was his way of contributing to the church. I only found out about this far, far after the fact, that he never did it. And partly, I think that was because my dad was the opposite of a show-off. And also because he didn't think very highly of himself and didn't want anybody else to do it anyway. Like, he was embarrassed to be around a church. Didn't consider himself a church person. But I thought that was a great way to give a gift. Always loved that. Dad's doorknobs. You could fast and pray for someone else in secret, someone who's going through a tough period of life. Well, I don't eat for a few days and take all that time that you would spend planning, preparing, or eating meals and just pray for that person and never tell them, never tell anyone, and see if it works. I mean, it's a risk. It's sowing into uncertainty and faith with sacrifice. Very Jesus, that sort of thing. When he was fasting for 40 days in the wilderness, he was probably thinking about other people and not so much himself, right? Because then he came back to town and started his public ministry. Another way to do this is what I call secret sufferings. How many of you suffer in life, just by a show of hands? How many of you suffer? Anyone? How many of you are suffering right now? How many of you are suffering on account of this sermon? Yeah, I'm just serving you. I'm just mortifying your flesh. That's what I do. That's why I'm here. Well, we all suffer, right? And when we suffer, there's a temptation to show it off. This is like, I'm suffering, and I can't make my suffering go away, but I at least can make it significant. And the way I can make it significant is by telling everybody on Facebook about it. You know? And there's a balance here, because look, if you are struggling and you need help, you have to ask, right? So that's humility. But are you asking so that you can get help, or are you asking so that people think you're important, you know? And human nature is tricky that way, you know? We get all fleshly and screwed up about it. So at least from time to time, when you're suffering in life from something, like you're tempted to despair about something, the best way to solve your grief or your frustration is to never speak of it. And that releases power that may well help you deal with the problem. Yeah. Sometimes when you speak of suffering, all you're doing is multiplying fear and panic and despair. And by not speaking about it, sometimes that's the way to release power and freedom in your life. You have to be wise about that, right? You have to be wise about it. And to, as Jesus said, salt yourself with fire. So like, think, okay, am I asking for help, or am I just demonstrating my victimhood, making me feel all righteous? You know, and you can see a lot. You can see a lot of both. Yeah. Social media, not a great place to ask for help. Social media, great place to celebrate victimhood. Right, and so you feel the spirit of it sometimes. So, legitimate cries for help, awesome. But secret sufferings can be equally awesome. I'm just not going to make a big deal about this. It hurts, but I'm not going to make a big deal about it. And that can really make you the sort of person for whom there's more than meets the eye. Got to be careful with that one, but you can think about it. On balance, though, I think the most general piece of advice is you got to develop a secret life. In one of those fashions that I mentioned, or one that you come up with on your own, you have to develop a good secret life, not a bad secret life. Those are easy to develop. You don't even have to think about it. But to develop a good secret life with some intention, and that's the thing about fasting, it's intentional, right? It's something that you have to pursue. You have to decide to go for it. Otherwise, you'll just follow your stomach around all day. You do good deeds openly for to glorify God, but you do good deeds secretly to get rewards, power from God. So do that. Have that be part of your life. This is a revolutionary Jesus teaching. People will see your godly works, but they won't be able to explain how you pull them off. How did he do that? How did she do that? There must be more to that person than meets the eye. Oh, you have no idea. You have no idea, and you never will. But you're going to experience the blessing of it. That's how we roll in the kingdom of heaven on earth, right? That's different about us. That is not the spirit of the world. It's not the spirit of the world. The spirit of the world is brash and pontificating, and everybody wants to celebrate their suffering. And I don't know, man. I wish they'd all just shut up sometimes. And maybe listen for the voice of God in secret. And I long to meet people for whom there's more than meets the eye. You know, I get a little bored meeting with people who are all in your face with it. It's like, I don't trust them. I do trust the people for whom I feel there's more than meets the eye. And so does God. So does God. You know, and that's really what we're about. It's just that the world's not going to help you be about that. You got to do that yourself. You know, that's what Jesus is teaching about. That's what I think this passage is about. For your contemplation, for your own growth, and for your own authenticity. There is nothing on this earth quite like an authentic Christ follower. I mean, you know, you meet one of those and you know. You know, you know. You don't know why you know, but you know. And we have plenty of authentic Christ followers around Blue Water, which is why it's such a privilege for me to be part of this place. A lot of people are way better Christians than I am, and that's how I like it. It's inspiring and helpful, and I benefit from the momentum that they bring to our community. They don't have to show off. I know that they're doing stuff behind the scenes that I don't know about. I know that they're blessing people in ways that those people don't even know about. And God trusts them, and God is making something of them that is mysterious and powerful. Yeah, oh, maybe you're one of them. Father God, I pray for the work of the Holy Spirit in the room. I pray that you, Lord, as Jesus promised, would reward and pay the brothers and sisters here who have that secret life, that authentic life before God and before God alone. You see it, Lord. And that is enough. You see the sacrifices. You see the integrities. You see the secret kindnesses that they do. You see the same things that no one else pays attention to. And that is enough. It is as it should be. And in the name of Jesus, those of us with willing hearts say this morning, we don't want any recognition beyond God's recognition. We want a secret identity with God. Secret agents of the kingdom. License to bless. I'm just going to give the Holy Spirit another 30 seconds to chat with you. I'm sure he will.